Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Ahead of the coronation of King Charles III, some may ask, what's the point of modern monarchies? Join me, Catty Kay, as I visit royal houses across Europe, where kings and queens are swapping palaces for apartments and finding their place in a new era. It's a surprising story featuring scandals, shamans, and a royal dynasty plotting its return. Stream Europe's Royals Revealed on BBC Select. Find out more at bbcselect.com/Europe's Royals.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jaleel, and at 13 hours GMT on Thursday, the 27th of April, these are our main stories. Diplomats work to extend the ceasefire in Sudan with just hours to go before it expires. Turkey's President Erdogan cancels his election campaign appearances for a second day after falling ill. Spain endures a record-breaking heatwave. Also in this podcast, the Vatican grants women a greater voice in the Catholic Church. And could machines develop feelings?
We may very shortly be in a society where we're surrounded with systems that we can't avoid feeling a conscious, and that itself will be incredibly disruptive.
Scientists warn against giving artificial intelligence a human level of consciousness. As we record this podcast, there are just hours to go before the ceasefire in Sudan is due to expire. And the United Nations and neighbouring South Sudan, along with other African nations, are working hard to extend it. South Sudan says it's leading efforts to persuade the two generals in charge of Sudan's army and the rival paramilitary Rapid Support Forces to agree to another three-day ceasefire, inviting them for face-to-face discussions in the South Sudanese capital, Juba. Sudan's army has said it's willing to extend the truce, but so far there's been no response from the RSF. South Sudan's Foreign Minister, Deng Dao Deng, stressed the importance of both sides coming together with the East African Regional Bloc, IGAD, for peace talks.
We hope that General Dagalo will be able to respond as President Burhan responded, and will build a concrete measures and concrete step. What need to be done? And we cannot do this unless by agreement of both parties. The process is not owned from outside, but the process should be owned by the leaders and by the Sudanese people and other political forces.
In the past couple of weeks, more than 500 people have died in the power struggle between the two forces. With civilians caught in the crossfire, tens of thousands have fled Sudan. There are now shortages of fuel, food and limited access to doctors or clean water. Our diplomatic correspondent, Paul Adams, is monitoring events in Sudan from Nairobi in Kenya.
This does represent quite a concerted effort by regional leaders to try and force the hand of the two generals who are leading this conflict. The idea would be twofold, probably. One, to get another three-day ceasefire to extend the one that runs out tonight. And then also perhaps that would lead to face-to-face discussions between the warring parties to end the conflict. That at least is the intention as expressed by the South Sudanese foreign minister speaking to the BBC a short time ago. They're also obviously keen to establish humanitarian corridors in Khartoum and other cities that have been affected by the fighting to try and address what is an increasingly dire humanitarian situation.
A dire humanitarian situation and particular concern about fighting in West Darfur.
I think the concern kind of changes almost from hour to hour as reports come of situations in different parts of the country. I mean, certainly Khartoum and the neighbouring area have experienced some of the worst violence. But as you say, Darfur has also seen some very significant violence. And in fact, this morning we had reports of the deputy police commissioner in West Darfur being assassinated. We're not quite sure what the details are surrounding that, but the security situation there is supposed to have deteriorated. with citizens apparently seizing a police station and the weapons inside it. So it's a very volatile situation in several parts of the country, while in other parts of the country, life goes on pretty much as normal. But obviously there is a fear that as this ceasefire, which is already a fairly shaky affair, the existing one, as it comes to a close without any immediate prospect of it being replaced, then that security situation could worsen right across the country.
And meanwhile, many nations are in a race against time to evacuate their citizens.
That's right. And, you know, there is a sense that that window may be closing, at least in terms of the use of the airstrip north of Khartoum that has been used a lot by Britain and other countries in the last couple of days. It could continue to be used. It is an area that is secured by the Sudanese military. It is obviously a viable route out of the country, though the key thing there is how easy it is for people in Khartoum and the surrounding area to actually reach it, because you've got to go through quite a network of checkpoints along streets that are pretty dangerous and in a situation in which fuel and transport is increasingly difficult. And you know, but there are other routes as well. And significantly, the long drive out to Port Sudan on the Red Sea, where there are regular vessels there that are available to carry people across to Saudi Arabia. So there are routes out, but they're all arduous and they all present different levels of difficulty.
Paul Adams. Turkey's President Erdogan will face his toughest challenge yet in crucial elections due in less than 3 weeks' time, with opinion polls showing him neck and neck with his main opponent. So his decision at the height of campaigning to cancel public appearances for 2 days in a row for health reasons is being followed with intense interest. Recep Tayyip Erdogan has dominated Turkish politics for the past two decades. But even if he does get back on the campaign trail soon, he faces a real prospect of defeat amid widespread anger over his handling of the economy and February's devastating earthquake. Our senior international correspondent, Orla Gerin, who's in Istanbul, told us what was known about his illness.
What we can say for certain to the question of how sick is he? He's sick enough not to have been able to carry out his program of activities yesterday. We were actually due to travel with the president yesterday from Ankara on a new high-speed train. Of course, he was going to be in a different carriage. But we were already in our seats waiting to depart the station when there was a last-minute announcement that he wouldn't be joining the train, and three other campaign events were cancelled yesterday. Last night, we got the news that he will not be attending a very major event here today. That's the opening of Turkey's first nuclear power station. He will now be joining that ceremony only by video link. Now, there's less than 3 weeks to the polls, as you mentioned. This is a battle for every single vote. It's an incredibly tight contest. So for the president to not be seen out and about at this stage is certainly raising a lot of questions. We first became aware that there was an issue on Tuesday night. He was giving a live interview to several journalists. The camera was not on him at the time, but we could hear a kind of a gasp, and then the broadcast was interrupted for 20 minutes. He reappeared afterwards looking extremely pale and said, look, I've had a very busy schedule. I've been working very hard. I've picked up a stomach bug. So that is the official line.
But the fact that he has pulled out of these appearances at this time does seem to indicate it could possibly be serious. And this comes at a time when he's facing possibly the most serious challenge that he's had in his long time in power.
Well, his officials are trying to say that it's not serious. They had to go so far yesterday as to deny speculation and claims on social media that he had suffered a heart attack. He is a man of 69 with a punishing schedule, particularly at the moment. He has had some health issues in the past. In 2006, he fell unconscious and had to be rushed to hospital. We know he had surgery, intestinal surgery in 2011. But yes, this is the fight of his life. The latest opinion polls, most of them are giving a narrow lead to his rival for the presidency. That's a secular candidate, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, who is running for a combined alliance of opposition parties. And in fact, he was one of the first to publicly wish the president a speedy recovery.
Orla Gerin in Turkey. Spain is already suffering from a long-running drought. Now, even though it's only April, it's set for a week of temperatures that are forecast to shatter records, possibly going as high as 40 degrees Celsius. That's around 20 degrees higher than normal. The Prime Minister, Pedro Sanchez, has warned of the continuing challenge posed by climate change. This woman in Seville in southern Spain says people there are used to this level of heat, but not at this time of year.
It's true that the heat today is not normal. It's totally unusual for it to be 40 degrees. The only thing that is true is that here in Andalusia, especially in Seville, we're used to the heat.
Our correspondent in Madrid is Guy Hedgecoe.
Temperatures have been rising throughout the week. We've been warned that this week was going to be unusually hot, with temperatures of around 10 to 15 degrees higher than normal for this time of year. And we were told that towards the end of the week, it was going to get particularly hot. So the authorities have been warning people. They've been giving the kind of warnings that you would expect to hear in July or August. That is, telling people to stay indoors at the hot times of day, in the afternoon and the early evening, warning that elderly people and small children are particularly at risk. And I think people are turning the air conditioning on, if they have it, and just trying to stay out of the heat at those hot times of day. There are some unusual measures being taken in some parts of the country, for example in schools, where classes are being brought forward to earlier in the day so that children are not in the heat when it's getting really, really hot later on.
And is this part of an overall trend in Spain of generally rising temperatures?
Yes, it does seem to be. I mean, for example, last year was particularly hot. We seem to be seeing not so much higher temperatures in Spain, but just longer summers, starting earlier and finishing later. That has been very much a trend in recent years. And I mean, last year, I remember, you know, I was covering a heat wave in May here in Spain, and there was a mini heat wave, and that was seen as extremely unusual. This year, you know, we're having that same conversation in April. And the feeling is that it's not so much the high temperatures that you really notice, it's just how long these warm spells or hot spells seem to last. And it is lasting longer and longer, the Spanish summer.
The Prime Minister's been talking about the continuing challenge posed by climate change. That must clearly be a big issue for many Spaniards.
Yes, it is. And I think, for example, you know, one of the big worries here, which we've already been seeing for months now, is a major drought across the country. Up in the northeast of the country, in Catalonia, for example, it hasn't rained in a sustained way for 2.5 years. So reservoirs there are at extremely low levels. There are major restrictions on water use. And so those are, you know, some of the challenges that are being presented by this. And the government has been very vocal in saying that this is caused by climate change. It has to be countered using measures, and there has to be a broader policy to try and battle climate change. But here in Spain, the feeling is very much that climate change is having an impact already. And it can be seen in people's everyday lives, whether it's on the reservoirs or people not being able to water their gardens because of lack of water, or having to turn their air conditioning on at an unusually early time of year.
Guy Hedgecoe in Madrid. It's been described as a significant crack in the stained glass ceiling. For the first time, Pope Francis will allow women to vote at a global meeting of bishops when it's held in October. While the overwhelming majority of those with voting rights will still be men, the move has been hailed as historic by those seeking a more inclusive Roman Catholic Church. In a further break with tradition, Pope Francis announced that voting rights would also be extended to 70 hand-picked non-clerical members of the religious community, and he hoped that half of these would be women. For more on this, my colleague Victoria Uwonkunda spoke to Deborah Rose, co-director of Future Church, a Catholic organisation seeking greater involvement of lay people.
Well, I think it's a little like a mini volcano. It is extremely paradigm shifting in the Catholic Church. The authority structure, those people who have made decisions for all these years, that is coming to an end, and we are seeing the opening of real diversity in terms of decision making, and especially as the doors have been opened to women having a deliberative voice in this important decision-making body in the Catholic Church, the Synod.
So what kind of decisions are taken in these kind of assemblies, and how important are they to the church and its followers?
The key difference is this is a real opening, and for 70 non-bishops, which Pope Francis has said he wants half of those to be women, they will be actual members. In the past, they've been auditors, which means they just listen, they can give input, but they have no voting voice, no deliberative voice in the decision-making. And now they will not only participate, they will not only give input on the various sections, but they will actually vote on the final product, which Pope Francis has said in a previous decree that when this body votes and agrees on something, it will become ordinary magisterium, which means it has a very high level of authority within the Catholic Church.
And so how do you think the wider church is going to be receiving this news?
Those who have been working for reform of the structures, inclusion of women, LGBTQI people, divorced and remarried Catholics, there's just a whole long list of people who have been excluded for a very long time from participation. I think they're going to be overjoyed. But I think those who have a more traditional or conservative bent will be frightened by this. The notion that women are actually going to move into decision-making roles is very frightening for some. And I think the majority of Catholics will go along in the end, because once something becomes enshrined in the Catholic Church, people do tend to move toward it.
Deborah Rose of the Catholic group Future Church. A unique art installation has been built in Athens, highlighting the wastefulness of fast fashion and its social and environmental impact in Africa. It's called Return to Sender, and it uses second-hand clothing that's sent to African countries in large quantities as donations. The group behind it is an art collective from Nairobi. Harry Bly has been finding out more.
Return to Sender is an enormous outdoor installation, a pavilion made out of large, tightly packed cubes or bales of used clothing wrapped in plastic. It was created by the Kenyan art collective, The Nest. Katerina Gregor is the project's curator.
There's something rather paradoxical in it, because it's at the same time attractive as it is disturbing, because these bales of clothing, as they're packed very well, you know, very tightly together, they create a kind of patchwork, a collage of different bright coloured fabrics. So it looks, you know, very enticing, but upon closer observation, you obviously see that there's a subtext that is rather dystopian, actually.
The installation aims to draw attention to the environmental issues of fast fashion, which, when sent to African countries, often goes to waste.
What happens is that a lot of our clothing ends up in Africa, and more than 40% of this clothing, which is supposed to go there as secondhand clothing, actually ends up in rubbish dumps.
Katerina explains why the installation is important for Greece.
Here in Greece, there's actually a rather relatively low environmental consciousness as regards fast fashion. And so the project was specifically intended to, you know, raise awareness and generate a discussion about how quickly and easily and often without thinking we consume cheap clothes.
Return to Sender was originally commissioned for Documenta, contemporary art event which takes place every 5 years in the German city of Kassel. It's hoped that after Athens, Return to Sender will move on to more cities in richer nations where visitors can experience the unseen challenges posed by cheap clothing.
Harry Bly. Still to come in this podcast.
Something touched me deep inside the day.
Wow.
The music
The South Korean president gives an unexpected performance at the White House.
Ahead of the coronation of King Charles III, some may ask, what's the point of modern monarchies? Join me, Catty Kay, as I visit royal houses across Europe, where kings and queens are swapping palaces for apartments, and finding their place in a new era. It's a surprising story featuring scandals, shamans, and a royal dynasty plotting its return. Stream Europe's Royals Revealed on BBC Select. Find out more at bbcselect.com/Europe's Royals.
More and more on the Global News podcast, we've been covering the rapid advance of artificial intelligence and, in particular, apps like ChatGPT. Its AI can answer questions, summarise complex information and even write a love poem. But it doesn't have feelings, at least not yet. This week, a group of scientists from around the world has written an open letter calling for more research to be done on the prospect of AI gaining a human level of consciousness. One of the signatories is Anil Seth, a professor of neuroscience at the University of Sussex here in Britain. My colleague Martha Carney asked him how he would define human consciousness.
When we wake up in the morning and open our eyes, it's not that our brain is just doing all kinds of complicated processing. We see things, we have experiences. And when we say something like, I feel happy or hungry, we're not just saying words. There's a feeling of hunger or happiness within us. Consciousness is any kind of experience whatsoever. That's something that we have, that other animals have. It's something that I don't think AI has at the moment, but it's very difficult to rule out that future AI might have this, and that would come with all kinds of complications and challenges.
And so that's why you think there is a need for further research in this field?
I think that's absolutely right. The key point here is that consciousness is not the same thing as intelligence. So we humans, we're both intelligent, or we think we're intelligent, and we know we're conscious. So we tend to think the two things go together. They may not. And in fact, in other animals, they probably don't. But opinions differ. We don't really know what it is about the biological brain that gives rise to this everyday miracle of consciousness. So in order to understand whether and how it's even possible in machines, we really do need more research into this area. We also need research into consciousness to help us better understand and treat things like psychiatric and neurological disorders and other important things in society.
And I suppose the temptation is always going to be to assume that AI is thinking in the same way that we are, that anthropomorphism, if you like, but you would warn against that.
For me, that's the really near-term danger. And we're already nearly there. I mean, Siri was difficult enough, Siri and Alexa and things. But now we've got these chatbots like GPT. They're very convincing. And yes, you're right. Our human psychology tends to project human-like qualities into things that seem superficially similar. So when ChatGPT tells us some stuff, we tend to think, oh, it's really thinking. It's really believing. It's maybe even really feeling things, when all it's doing under the hood is just predicting what the most likely next word is. So we may very shortly be in a society where we're surrounded with systems that we can't avoid feeling a conscious, even if they are not. And that itself will be incredibly disruptive, because it will change how we trust things, what we believe, what we feel some kind of ethical concern towards. So I think we need research both into how humans respond to machines that seem conscious, and in the longer term, research into what it actually might take for a machine to be conscious. Because, by the way, I really don't think we should be trying to build conscious machines. They could be saddled with all kinds of safety concerns. And I think, most of all, we could be introducing vast new forms of potential suffering. Because as soon as something is conscious, then we've got an ethical obligation to it as well, not just what it might do to us.
Professor Anil Seth speaking to Martha Carney. When the legendary footballer Pelé died at the end of last year, Brazil declared 3 days of mourning. It was a send-off befitting a king, which incidentally is what Brazilians called him. Pelé was always more than a sportsman in his native country. To many, he was a leader and a statesman, the embodiment of supreme talent and excellence. And that's now been reflected in a Brazilian dictionary, which has included his name as an adjective, meaning exceptional, incomparable, and unique. Daniel Galas from BBC Brazil told us more.
This is a word that Brazilians do use for a long time when they want to say someone is extraordinary, out of the ordinary, the best in what they do. It's something that Brazilians do use it, but this was kind of an orchestrated campaign by the Pelé Foundation that is run by his estate, and also by some charities in Brazil and media activists. So it is in one of the dictionaries at least. And it's, I suppose it's fair usage because Brazilians do tend to use this in everyday life. It's common to have, you know, adjectives out of people's names, but not the name itself. So, for example, Kafkaesque or from Kafka's work, or quixotic from Don Quixote, the novel, but never like just the single word Pelé singled out to become one word in the dictionary. So it is extraordinary, like Pelé himself, perhaps.
Daniel Gallas. Now to the strange tale of a fugitive billionaire, a rap star, and a plot to influence the US government. Prakasrael Michel, better known as Prez, is a member of the 1990s hip-hop group The Fugees and has become a successful Hollywood producer. A New York jury found him guilty on 10 charges, including money laundering, making illegal political donations, and failing to identify himself as an agent of China. And as we heard from Dan Friedman, a journalist for Mother Jones magazine, it all stemmed from his relationship with a disgraced Malaysian businessman.
Joe Lo, as he was known, was supposedly a Malaysian financier who was involved in the looting of a Malaysian state development fund, a massive theft from that fund starting in the late 2000s. And then he came to the United States around that time. And according to the United States Justice Department, he was laundering the stolen money, and he was doing stuff like, and he was a financier of the movie Wolf of Wall Street with Leonardo DiCaprio, and he was holding all these incredibly lavish parties where he invited celebrities. Sometimes he paid celebrities to come to these parties, and he met people, including Praz Michel, the former member of the Fugees, who by this time was on a solo career and was doing different projects. In 2012, Joe Lo wanted to get close to the Obama campaign. He wanted to meet President Obama and have his picture taken with him. And he gave Praz Michel $20 million, some of which Praz then used to funnel to the Obama campaign. He used straw donors or conduits, people who he gave money to make donations so that he could exceed the legal limits on donations to a presidential campaign. That's illegal. A few years later, in 2017, Joe Lo realized that he was being investigated by the Justice Department for his role in the 1MDB theft and had his assets frozen. He then wanted political help, finding a fixer or a lobbyist who could go to the new Trump administration and help him try to get the investigation killed. And Praz knew a woman in the entertainment industry who was a Republican donor, and knew a even bigger Republican donor by the name of Elliot Broidy, who was one of the top fundraisers for the Republican National Committee and had raised a lot of money for Trump. And this group arranged to be paid massive sums by Joe Lo, this Malaysian criminal, to try to get the Justice Department to kill this investigation. They then were introduced to a Chinese vice minister for security who Joe Lo was attempting to cultivate in China. And through that connection, they also were asked to begin lobbying for the extradition of a Chinese dissident and wanted criminal in China who had fled to the United States named Guo Wenghui. And they began a separate additional lobbying campaign to try to get him extradited from the United States to China.
Dan Friedman of Mother Jones. Well, tensions are high between Washington and Beijing, and not only because of China's attempts to interfere in American domestic affairs. Chinese claims over self-governing Taiwan are growing louder, even as the US commitment to defend it appears to be deepening. Earlier this month, China rehearsed a military blockade of Taiwan. And now the US has just carried out large-scale combat drills nearby in the Philippines. The people who live there find themselves caught between two superpowers. Laura Bicker reports from the northern Philippine islands, which are a short distance from Taiwan.
This is the most northern inhabited island in the Philippines. Life has hardly changed for decades, but in the last few years, they're beginning to feel an increasing amount of tension as the rhetoric grows over the island to the north. Just a couple of hundred kilometres from here is Taiwan. We untether the boat and head out to sea with local fisherman Cyrus Malupa.
Sometimes the Chinese fishermen used to harass us. But when we reported that to the government placed Philippine Marines there on duty.
The Filipino President Ferdinand Marcos Jr. has taken a more assertive stance with Beijing, sending out Navy and Coast Guard patrols to project strength in contested waters. Beijing claims sovereignty over almost the entire South China Sea, despite an international court ruling that that assertion has no legal basis.
Mainland China is a giant for us. So the presence of the U.S. Military here in the Philippines, for me, it's good.
This year, the United States and the Philippines held their largest joint combat drills. The exercises included defending an island from potential aggressors. That took place on the Batanes Islands.
Our method of operation here and a goal of our campaign in the region is to deter conflict from ever occurring.
Major General Joseph Ryan is the commanding general of the 25th Infantry Division, which took part in the air assault drills. He denies their increased presence will provoke the People's Republic of China.
We don't want a war with the PRC. We do not want that. We do not desire that. We are not provoking that. A war with the PRC is good for nobody.
The US is keen to show off its capabilities in Asia, holding ever more military drills with allies throughout the region. For Washington, this is not just about a display of shiny new arms. It's about shoring up alliances, and that includes with the Philippines, whose location is an asset. We've come all the way up to Santa Ana. This is a tiny village which sits at the northern tip of Luzon, and there's a naval base here. And when we were on our way, I thought, well, this will be a very large naval base because this is one of the bases that the United States has access to. Well, how wrong was I? It is a tiny naval base with very few resources apart from an airstrip that gives it access to the Taiwan Strait.
It's not really a base. It may be a camp, a Boy Scout camp. It's really a camp.
The governor of the province of Cagayan is Manuel Mamba. He is unhappy that two of the four new bases the U.S. can now access in the Philippines are in his province.
This is not my call or the call of our people. It's the call of our national leaders. We will abide by it. We may disagree with it. But really, it's all because we don't want war. We don't want to be caught on the two superpowers.
Manuel Mamba, the governor of Cagayan in the Philippines, ending that report by Laura Bicker. Let's stay with American military involvement in East Asia, but shift our focus from the Philippines to South Korea. In the last edition of the Global News podcast, we reported that the US had struck a landmark deal to defend its ally with nuclear weapons in the event of a nuclear attack by North Korea. The spectre of war hung heavily over this summit in Washington between President Joe Biden and the South Korean leader Yoon Suk-yeol. But away from the politics, President Yoon provided a moment of cheer with an unexpected karaoke performance during a state dinner at the White House. His song of choice? Don McLean's American Pie. He told guests it was one of his favourites when he was growing up.
A long, long time ago. Music used to make me smile. And I really felt my chance that I could make those people dance. They were very happy for a while. And February made me shiver with the paper I deliver. Bad news on the doorstep. I couldn't have one more step. I can't remember if I tried when I rattled about his willow bride. Something touched me deep inside the day the music died.
A very enthusiastic White House audience cheering the South Korean president's rendition of American Pie. And it seems to have gone down well with Don McLean himself. He's been sharing video clips of the performance on social media. President Biden said sadly the singer wasn't able to join the two leaders at the White House, but had sent a signed guitar, which was then presented to President Yoon. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was produced by Peter Goffin. It was mixed by Martin Baker. And the editor, as always, is Karen Martin. I'm Jeanette Jalil. Until next time, goodbye. Ahead of the coronation of King Charles III, some may ask, what's the point of modern monarchies? Join me, Catty Kay, as I visit royal houses across Europe, where kings and queens are swapping palaces for apartments and finding their place in a new era. It's a surprising story featuring scandals, shamans, and a royal dynasty plotting its return. Stream Europe's Royals Revealed on BBC Select. Find out more at bbcselect.com/Europe's Royals.